I'm Emma Taylor.
I'm Joanna Shanks.
And you're listening to Murder, She Spoke.
So we're on episode 3 now, which feels quite exciting because I didn't think that we would get to this point, Emma. I thought that we would have people saying, your podcast was rubbish, I'm not interested, don't want to hear what you have to say about anything and your unqualified opinions, but people seem to be enjoying what we're putting out there. So who are we to deny the people? So I thought it made sense that we probably did a little bit of an introduction. Yeah, just introduce ourselves. So I was brought up in Scotland. I am actually English. Don't know if you know that, Emma.
Yeah, I do. But I just chose to ignore it.
You like me in spite of the fact that I'm
half my family's English, so I would never hold yeah. that against you.
So moved up to Scotland when I was 5, lived in Edinburgh, moved about loads, left Scotland about a year and a half ago, now live in the south of England, where it feels like the sun is always shining and the weather is beautiful, and therefore I am happy. I live with my fiance and our two fur balls, Monty and Mika, who are our cats. Emma, I don't know if you agree with me, but I feel like people that are into true crime, I'm making a sweeping generalization here, but I feel like people who are into crime also tend to be cat people.
Yes, I find that. Or animal people generally, but more specifically cat people. Yeah. Do you have anything else to share with us? No.
I'm not really that interested, so I don't think there's anything else that's either relevant or people would even care about knowing, to be honest. I have a 9-to-5 like anybody else. I'm not yet a high-flying detective in Scotland Yard, maybe one day. And other than being completely obsessed with true crime, I'm otherwise quite dull.
You are not. That's probably what brought us... One of the things that brought us together, though, shared interests, and definitely true crime is massively up there. How long have we been friends for now?
We have actually been friends for 7 years.
Wow, that's so nice. And I would say most of my social media profile pictures have been taken by you. So that's the sign of a good friend.
Do you know what? There's something... I feel like you enhance my pictures. Oh, I feel like whenever there's a photo of me and you're in it, it looks 10 times better.
Oh, I feel the same way.
We have some lovely photographs together.
Is that the only reason I'm being picked as a bride?
No,
so
not
I can
at
make
all.
So it can make your wedding pictures look awesome. Hold on, wait a minute, right. Is it because I'm standing next to you, do you think you look more attractive in comparison, or...?
Absolutely not. I don't know what it is. I just feel like you're so photogenic.
We complement each other, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe, because I feel like I'm... I wouldn't say I was photogenic or not, but I feel like you are really photogenic, and I feel like you take such a good picture, and therefore, I like pictures that have you in them.
Oh, that is the cutest thing. That is genuinely so sweet. Oh,
and
God.
Honestly, some of, like, one of my absolute favourite pictures ever is one that was taken at your wedding of me and you. I think it's such a beautiful photo.
I do love that photo. It's such a good photo. I remember being so hot in that dress. It's strapless. Why am I so hot? But it was super heavy.
I remember you saying to me at your wedding, I fucking stink. I fucking stink. I had to go to the toilet and wipe myself with baby wipes.
You feel like you want to be this, you know, like a princess or something. But you're roasting. You've got to cuddle everyone. It's actually a really stressful day.
It would be lovely if you introduced yourself to our listeners and told us a little bit about yourself.
For some reason, I always clam up a little bit. I'm Emma. I live in South Queensbury, which is just outside of Edinburgh, and it's got a gorgeous old seaside little town. It's got cobbled streets, and I love living here. I lived in Edinburgh before that for 7 years with my now husband, Richard. We've got two cats as well. They're called Nero and Caesar, and they are super, super fluffy Siberian forest cats, which are very, very cute, and I'm a little bit obsessed with them. kind of crazy cat lady have an Instagram for them and all that jazz. So yeah, I'm super cool, as you can tell. Like Joe, I have a 9-to-5 as well, but this is just something that we fancy doing for quite a long time. We're both major true crime buffs and love listening to podcasts. So something we both wanted to do. But I think now more than ever, because of the quarantine, we've got the time to do it and people are listening to podcasts. It just seemed like a really good time to do it. I think that's kind of all there is to know about me. I love cooking. I love baking. Anything to do with food. I love to travel. And I also do aerial hoop and pole fitness as well, which I guess is kind of a bit of an unusual hobby.
So tell me about quarantine life, Emma. What have you been up to? Have you been reading anything? Have you been listening to anything good? Have you been watching anything?
So we are a bit obsessed with Westworld. Set in the future, where they have created a theme park that people can go to and all the other people in it are robots. But you don't know, they're made of human flesh and you can kill them, sleep with them, do whatever you want to. And then at the end of the day, they take them away and fix them and put them back. And there's different worlds based on different times in history. And one of them is the Wild West. And that's where this first one's set. And it's all about, you think it's going to be a Western, but it's not. It's really interesting. One of the guests falls in love with one of the hosts that's a robot and they circumvent the narrative as it is. And it's all about what the corporation that runs this is actually trying to do, because it's only very rich people that can afford to go. And they're actually collecting data on these people based on how they interact with the narratives and the storylines that are going on. So from the first episode, you think, this is a bit strange. I don't really like it. I'm not massively into Westerns anyway. And I thought, oh, I don't know if this is my kind of thing. But it's just really fascinating watching this. So these hosts go through the same story over and over again. And then they start to gain awareness, some of them. And a couple of them, it's almost like they wake up and they realize what's going on around them and that they're being used. They're being murdered every day. They're being raped in some cases, and they gain awareness and things start to change.
That sounds really interesting.
It's just amazing, because people feel when they go into the park that they are going somewhere that has no consequences, so they behave exactly how their urges lead them to behave, because they think they're just robots, they can do whatever they like to them.
And they can't think, they can't feel.
Exactly. So they behave in these atrocious, appalling ways, but actually all that information is being stored. And when the hosts start to wake up and remember, what do you think they're going to want? They're going to want revenge.
Wow.
It's good.
Interesting.
You need to watch it.
So what else have you been up to? Have you been listening to anything, reading anything?
As always, I do listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. I tend to go through binges where I'll find a podcast and then I'll listen to a whole bunch of them in a row.
Like you, I go through binges and I'll listen to so many and I'll move on to something else, because normally I find out about podcasts way after they've come out and way after there's a bunch of hype about them. I'm never really in there at the beginning, with the exception being that I just started listening to a podcast which is quite new. There's not been a huge amount of episodes. It's called Strictly Stalking, and I'm completely up to date with that as well. What I like about it is that it's the victim speaking. They speak about everything from their perspective. There's two episodes, one with Deborah Newell, who was married to Dirty John. And then there's another interview with her daughter, Tara Newell. That's the one that killed him, yeah. But the podcast is really good. And I think one of the reasons I really like it is because I think that stalking is massively underrated, underreported, underprosecuted. I think there was a new law passed or proposed, which came about or was proposed last year, the Stalking Protection Act 2019, and it's an act to make provision for orders to protect persons from risks associated with stalking and for connected purposes. And my understanding is that if a person has unwanted contact, so that could be gifts, emails, things like that, I believe, on at least two occasions, that's the basis that they then have to approach the police and report it. I've had unwanted attention in the past. I know other people that have had unwanted attention in the past, which to deem it as stalking would probably sound extreme or dramatic. But the reality is that when it comes down to the description of what it is I know several people that have technically been victims of stalking, and I think it's not taken seriously enough, or wasn't taken seriously enough in the past. And I'm glad that there's this new legislation to actually protect people.
The podcast that you're talking about, I think that that is really interesting, because it is telling the story from the victim's perspective. And for so many victims, they've spent so long trying to prove what's happening to them, and almost gaslit to a point where they're doubting themselves. You go to the powers that be to try and get them to help you, and even then you're questioned and made to doubt yourself. So I think it's really powerful to be able to hear it from their point of view. I'm looking forward to listening to that.
I'm definitely keen to cover any stalking cases on our podcast.
If anyone's listening that knows of any stalking cases or is a survivor of stalking and wanted to talk to us, we'd be really interested in listening to that and having a chat with you.
I read Stranger Beside Me.
Oh, yes.
By Anne Rule. I did enjoy it. I am quite fascinated with Ted Bundy, I'll be honest. And I would recommend it.
Can I ask you a question? Ted Bundy, hot or not?
Not.
Exactly. He's not hot. Okay, this is probably not the most important thing about Ted Bundy. However, I would argue, whenever it's been put out there, it's all, oh, this handsome guy lured women to his car. No, they probably went because he was limping and they felt a bit sorry for him. He's not devastatingly attractive as the general media would have you believe. I think he looks quite creepy, actually.
I feel like this could be a new feature, serial killer, hot or not. Ted Bundy, I mean, maybe in the 70s, maybe just with his hair and his style and his charisma, maybe he had a thing going on that women really liked. I don't know. I've never seen the attraction, but then I can't honestly say hand on heart I've ever been attracted to a serial killer. So
that you know of?
That I know of. Now, I just want to take a minute to tell you about The Toolbox Scotland. They're located in Dalry in Edinburgh, a short walk from Haymarket. They sell loads, hand tools, power tools and garden tools at very competitive prices. They also have a website with free delivery on orders over £80. They sell a large range of brands, DeWalt, Craig, Makita, Stanley, Triton, Draper, Silverline, many, many more. They're open from Monday to Saturday if you want to stop by, or you can have a look online at their website, which is thetoolboxscotland.co.uk. That's thetoolboxscotland.co.uk.
I want to hear about your case. Tell me.
Okay, I'll tell you about my case that I have this week. I've gone a little rogue this week. My case actually isn't based in Scotland. However, there is a very tenuous connection to Glasgow, but it's a really good case. I was interested to research it, and I thought you'd be interested to hear about it. So I'm going to play the tenuous link, and I'm just going to do it.
I'll let you off with it this time.
I will make sure that my next case is firmly based in Scotland. Emma, I don't know if you've ever heard of this person, but it's an old one. This is the case of Mary Flora Bell.
I have, but it's been some time, so I'm perfectly happy for you to refresh my memory.
So, Mary Flora Bell. So she was born on the 26th of May, 1957. Her parents were Betty McCricket. She was actually a sex worker. She travelled to Glasgow often for work. That's my tenuous link. She was 17 years old when she had Mary, and her father was noted as Billy Bell, but it seems that he was actually came around when she was a baby, so perhaps brought her up. So independent accounts from family members suggest that Betty actually tried to get rid of Mary in her first few years after Mary was born. Apparently there was accounts that Mary fell, quote unquote, from a window and accidentally, quote unquote, took sleeping pills. There was mention of someone seeing her mum feeding sleeping pills to Mary like they were sweeties, but unverified. So they lived in an area called Scotswood, which was an economically depressed area of Newcastle. which had quite a high crime rate. There is a biography about her, which is called Cries Unheard, The Story of Mary Bell, which came out in 1998. That was actually written by someone else, a woman named Geeta Sereny. Within that book, Mary actually details that there was sexual abuse by her mother and her mother's clients. However, the publication was actually deemed controversial because Mary Bell received payment for participation in the book.
So the picture that I'm getting is of quite a depraved childhood, brought up in not the greatest of areas. She's clearly unwanted. There's abuse, there's possible sexual abuse, definitely emotional and neglect as well. I mean, from everything both of us know about killers in general, there's often neglect when they're children. It's not a healthy environment for someone to grow up in.
So weeks before Mary committed her first murder, at age 10, she'd been playing with a three-year-old boy at the time, and he was actually injured badly from a fall.
Prior to her playing with him?
No. His parents thought it was an accident. On May the 11th, 1968, so this is really shortly before her 11th birthday, she'd been accused of trying to choke other children, but no charges were filed. Then, the day before she turned 11, so on the May 25th, 1968, she strangled 4-year-old Martin Brown in an abandoned derelict house in Scotswood in England. So she left the scene to go and get a friend by the name of Norma Bell, no relation, but two local boys actually found the body before they returned. Apparently the police saw no obvious signs of violence, and there was an empty bottle of painkillers next to the boy's body. Therefore the police ruled his death as accidental. Mary showed up to Martin's family home and asked to see his body in the coffin. Then, shortly after Martin's murder, Mary and Norma actually broke into a nursery, vandalising it with notes confessing Mary's responsibility for Martin's death. And the notes also contained the promise that she would kill again, but the police assumed it was a prank, so they wrote it off.
You can understand why they would. It's so unbelievable. Almost too bizarre that you don't want to believe it.
So Mary confessed to her fellow classmates about killing Martin. However, she had a reputation for being a show-off and a liar, so nobody believed her. On the 31st of July, a couple of months later, she's age 11 at this point, 3-year-old Brian Howe was killed by strangulation by both Mary Flora Bell and her friend Norma Bell.
So she obviously had this method that she had either thought through or decided worked for her, if she'd been trying to strangle kids before that.
Yes, because obviously there was mention of her attempting to choke other children, but no charges were filed.
I wonder if that's behaviour that she'd witnessed.
Possibly.
How would you know as a child to do that? I feel like as a kid, you'd probably try and hit someone with something. I don't think I would have known without having seen it on a TV show or without having heard someone saying it, you know, that choking someone would kill them. I don't think I would have thought I was strong enough to do it either.
I agree, it's a valid point. Now, apparently, she murders 3-year-old Brian Howe, her and her friend Norma Bell. Then Mary mutilated his body with scissors, scratched his thighs, and she butchered his penis. And she also used a razor blade to carve M into his torso. Now, Brian's body was found hidden behind concrete blocks, and the coroner's report suggested that a child might have been involved in the murder due to the lack of force used in the attack. I mean, I know from being a complete true crime addict that it apparently takes a lot of force to strangle somebody, and movies and TV series would have us believe it happens within 20 seconds, but it doesn't. Apparently it takes a very long time, requires a lot of strength. Although the victim, Brian, was only 3 years old, she was only 11 years old. She's still quite a young child at that point.
Can I also play a bit of armchair psychologist for a second? Mm-hmm. I do have a psychology degree. I'm not entirely making this up, but just reading a little bit into her actions, the fact that she's only chosen male victims so far, and the fact that she's mutilated his genitals, I really wouldn't be surprised if any of that is not tied back to the sexual abuse.
So earlier we were talking about possible sexual abuse by her mother and her mother's clients. That was mentioned in the autobiography, which couldn't vouch for its authenticity because she received payment for it, and she therefore benefited from the publication of it. However, I'm completely unqualified. This is just purely my own speculation, but I would assume that if a young child has murdered a little boy, and definitely sort of sexual abuse or sexual exposure been involved.
I know it seems simplistic, but in my mind, you know, if you're Mary and older men have forced themselves on you or raped you or something like that, and you're taking the anger out on someone that you're able to, and to be fair, by butchering his genitals, he wouldn't be able to do that to anyone else. You wonder what went through her head and how broken she must have been to have gotten to that point.
So Brian's body was found hidden behind concrete blocks. And as I said, the coroner's report suggested that a child might have been involved because of the lack of force used in the attack. I'm making a massive assumption here, but I know that sometimes in cases where someone has been strangled, the hyoid bone fractures. I wonder if it was something like the lack of that led them to believe there was a lack of force.
That makes sense.
Now, apparently the police noted that both Norma and Mary were acting really strangely when the police confronted them with the witness accounts that they were both seen with Brian on the day of his murder. And Mary was also seen lurking outside Brian's burial and apparently was seen rubbing her hands together when his coffin arrived. I mean, that's...
so bizarre.
Very bizarre. So Mary was taken in for questioning and basically her story was inconsistent with Norma's. So both Norma Bell and Mary Bell were arrested and charged. And on the 17th of December 1968, Norma Bell was found not guilty. So that was Mary's friend who was involved or supposed to have been involved in the killing of Brian Howe. But Mary was found guilty of manslaughter on grounds of diminished responsibility.
Can I check? So Norma was there for the second killing. So she was brought over to see the body of Martin Brown. She had killed him and then she went to go and get Norma. So Norma wasn't there when the first boy was killed.
Correct.
So are we saying that the police or the courts or whoever it is, they've looked at it and seen that Mary's the one that's kind of tying these together and Norma was just an accessory? She was, what, coerced into it? Or
potentially.
Is that how they framed it?
I don't know. I don't have that information.
I'm just wondering if Norma was clearly there. She was also talking to people at school about it and that kind of thing. You wonder if she's essentially got off with murder as well.
I mean, obviously, they're both age 11. I don't know what Norma's background was. I guess it's possible that they were just friends. And if Mary, she was a bit of a liar, she told stories, people generally didn't believe what she had to say. Perhaps it was that she killed the first boy, Martin Brown. Then she might have gone back to her friend Norma and been like, well, guess what I did? She might have called her bluff and said, you know, she was talking nonsense, telling lies. Well, let me prove it. I can show you the body. Something like that. It might have been that during the second time, she was just there.
I think that children don't understand the gravity of situations like that either.
I agree.
And I think that it shows how kind of brutalized, or perhaps not, but allegedly how brutalized Mary had been. The fact that she could stand and rub her hands on the body was there. The fact that she showed an interest in seeing the body of the first boy as well. I think it's
a very bizarre detail.
Really bizarre, really odd, and quite warped.
Obviously, we're talking 1968 here, so a long time ago. I'm not sure what it was like back then, but my understanding is that to find somebody guilty on grounds of diminished responsibility is quite difficult.
Yes.
And the fact that she's also a child, completely assuming here, but I would imagine that would only make it all the more difficult.
Yes, I think that they probably would have had to demonstrate extreme mental health issues and concerns. Doesn't sound like she would have made that too difficult, though, based on her behaviour and the fact that the police, even from the start, thought that her behaviour was really odd and bizarre. The mutilation alone may have given them cause to say that she had diminished responsibility because it's such an extreme action.
I was thinking as well, this is 40 odd years ago, so we wouldn't have even had the knowledge that we have now about mental health conditions, I think to find somebody, especially a child, guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility in 1968, I feel that would be a hard task.
However, you could argue that if your brain hasn't fully developed and you are a child, you have diminished responsibility in some ways because you haven't got the full capacity of your morality. You know, not all the areas of your brain are fully formed. You haven't even reached adolescence.
Very valid point. Funny what you should say there. I'll touch on it a bit later, but about being fully formed and having all our
faculties, I think I said.
Apparently the court-appointed psychiatrist described her as displaying classic symptoms of psychopathy. And she was given an indefinite sentence of imprisonment. Initially, she was sent to the Red Bank Secure Unit in St. Helens in Lancashire. That's actually the same unit that John Venables would be sent to 25 years later. John Venables was one of the killers of James Bulger.
Markedly similar crimes.
If you think about it, so that her first victim was age 4, her second victim was age 3. She was 10 years old at the time of her first murder. She was 11 years old at the time of her second murder. James Bulger's killers were...
They were around 9 and 10, were they not?
And I believe that James Bulger, I'm sure he was also about 3 years old.
James Bulger was 2 when he passed away, and the boys that killed him were both 10 years old.
So quite similar circumstances.
Absolutely. And his body was mutilated also.
Correct. So she's been given an indefinite sentence of imprisonment, which is quite telling. Sent to this Red Bank Secure Unit in St. Helens in Lancashire. Then in 1980, so 12 years later, at age 23, she's released.
Wow.
So she's given an indefinite sentence, and then she's released age 23, 12 years later.
That's longer than either of those little boys got to live. You know, you just think it's so sad that they were taken from their mothers and their families. I just, to be honest, whenever I hear sentences, I always think, you know, it's never long enough. It never feels like it's long enough.
I agree.
But then the system can't hold people indefinitely.
It's always a different set of circumstances when they're dealing with a minor as well.
Absolutely. As we said before, people go through a lot of changes mentally, physically, within your brain, in your whole body, and especially I think that you can grow and you can learn, and there's a lot of rehabilitation programs in prisons and any kind of centres that people are held in. So do you write someone off because of something they did as a child? Is that fair? I don't know. I don't think I'm equipped to answer that question, but it's a real moral dilemma.
So she was released from Askham Grange Open Prison in 1980 at age 23. And she was granted anonymity and a new name. So again, very similar to James Bulger's killers. Apparently, she reportedly returned to Tyneside after her release multiple times. And then 4 years after her release, she actually had a daughter who was born in 1984. So Mary Bell was discovered by reporters in 1998, and they had to flee their home with bedsheets over their head. And it was only at that point that her daughter became aware of her mother's past. So she would have been 14 at this time when she found out about mother's past. Now, the anonymity was initially only granted for Mary Bell's daughter until she reached the age of 18. But then Mary Bell won a High Court battle in 2003, which extended the order for both Mary Bell and her daughter's anonymity for life. Then Mary Bell's daughter had a daughter. So that court order granting the anonymity for life was later updated to include Mary Bell's granddaughter, who was born in 2009, and their identities are still protected and their current whereabouts are unknown.
Wow. I mean, I don't know. I can't say I disagree with that.
Granting the order of anonymity.
Yeah. I mean, what she did was horrific, but she came from a really troubled place, and I don't know that she does deserve full responsibility for it. Maybe she does, maybe. I mean, does gender play a part in this? Am I because, you know, if you look at pictures of her, she was a really striking, beautiful little girl. Do I have it in my head that she's, you know, somehow less culpable? Which, you know, I mean, it makes no sense, but I'm James Bulger's killers. I'm looking at these boys, and then I'm looking at little Mary Bell. Have I got it in my head that because she's a little girl, she's somehow less guilty? It doesn't make any sense.
I was just about to say, playing devil's advocate, do you think it's right and just that James Bulger's killers were granted anonymity and they're allowed to lead a normal life now that they've been released and have been kept anonymous from the public? Do you think that's fair?
I don't know. I think that it's really difficult. I think that actually with a lot of these people, unfortunately, whilst they're technically anonymous, because of the way that the internet is now, people will out them. I don't know. I think that part of that living in fear for the rest of your life is penance as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. A few things to note, little extra points, which you might find interesting. Apparently, Mary Bell had brain damage to her prefrontal cortex, which was initially attributed to the fall, quote-unquote, she had as a child, but it was later attributed to childhood abuse by her mother in the first few years of her life. Now, if you're not an absolute crime addict and you don't know what that means, the prefrontal cortex is associated with decision-making. So the prefrontal cortex is the part of the cerebral cortex covering the front part of the frontal lobe, and it's associated with personality characteristics like planning complex cognitive behaviour, personality expression, decision-making, and moderating social behaviour. And
it's one of the most commonly damaged parts that people see in serial killers.
That's what just what I was about to say. It comes up a lot in people that have murdered, damage to the prefrontal cortex, basically.
Sorry for speaking over you before, but it was quite funny that we said it in sync, because it's just an absolutely classic biological finding. It's quite scary to think that your biology can affect you in such a way. Something like a fall, a knock on the head, or some kind of degeneration in a part of your brain could cause you to become an entirely different human being who makes completely different moral choices.
Absolutely. So just a couple of other facts for you. Apparently, Mary's mother sold many stories to the press after Mary's conviction and imprisonment. Yes, she obviously profited from her. And another little interesting fact which I came upon while I was doing the research for this case is apparently any court order which grants anonymity to a convicted person in Britain for life is sometimes referred to as a Mary Bell order.
Wow, that is interesting. I didn't know that.
There you go. So that is the case of Mary Flora Bell. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I'd heard of it many years ago. I think it's a really disturbing one. Like I said before, I remember seeing her picture, and I don't know why, it just kind of stuck with me. This kind of very sweet, innocent looking girl, and she's, you know, really cute. And you read what she's done, and it's just quite hard to align the two. It's just totally bizarre and heartbreaking, because you look at the background and where she came from, and perhaps I want to attribute some of it to that. Perhaps maybe she was a psychopath. Maybe she did enjoy it. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? I can only take from it what I've seen, but it's really complex. And I hope that wherever she is now, she's mentally well and happy, and same with her family. That's all I can think of it.
So do you have a lighthearted crime fact to cheer us up after that?
I absolutely do, and it's one that you will definitely appreciate given your recent return to eating lactose-based products.
Okay.
So I would argue that most people love cheese. I particularly love cheese, and I know that you do also.
Who doesn't love cheese?
Did you know that Russia has a black market for cheese?
You are joking.
I'm not joking. There is a severe shortage of cheese in Russia and really high prices. You'd think it's been a bit of a joke, but actually they're really serious about it, and they regularly arrest local criminal cheese rings. Seriously.
What? So, questions. Why is there a severe shortage of cheese in Russia. Imagine being a convicted criminal and people are like, what was your crime? And you're like, I was the head of a cheese ring. I feel like I'd be quite proud to have that as my criminal conviction.
If I ever become a criminal, I reckon that's the kind of criminal I become. So there is a ban on imported foods in Russia, and Russia doesn't have a massive cheese production industry. Therefore, right. There are too many people and too little cheese. Therefore, they are importing it illegally and circumventing the ban on imported goods. And it's had a boom in people writing about it. So if you want to Google Russian fromagicide, you will have a lot of interesting reading. I wonder if illicit cheese tastes better than legit cheese.
Did you hear about the Russian guy who was charged with fromagicide?
No.
He was sentenced to 25 years behind bars. So do you think that if someone gets arrested and charged for fromagicide, say they spent a few years behind bars for their crime, do you think when they are eventually released that they've matured?
Oh yes. That's the kind of quality content people are coming here for. Jesus Christ. We would love to hear from you if you have a case that you think you'd like to cover. We're primarily focusing on Scottish cases, but any cases that are of interest, especially unsolved, obscure cases, cases that need a bit of attention and some awareness raised. If you want to get in contact with us, our Instagram is Murder She Spoke Pod. Our Twitter handle is MSS_pod, and our email address is info@murdershespoke.net. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time.